Welcome to The Buyer's Desk, your weekly resource for all things natural food retail. Each month starts with a deep dive into SPINS data, spotlighting growth trends and key industry insights. Then I'll bring you conversations with industry leaders and highlight brands making waves in the natural channel. We'll wrap up each month with actionable strategies, collaborative discussions, and tactical tips to help you thrive. This season is packed with fresh perspectives, big ideas, and everything you need to stay informed in natural food retail.
Hi, my name is Kara Bittner, Director of the Natural Channel for Poppy, and I'm here to talk about how Poppy aligns with infra and why we're obsessed with the natural retail community. Poppy's a modern soda made with 5 grams of sugar, prebiotics, and ingredients you can love. The best part? It has the mouth-watering soda flavor you love, but with 5 grams of sugar. Our mission is to give people the freedom to love soda again without any of the typical soda baggage. And that's why Poppy aligns so well with infra retailers. Infra stores are known for introducing shoppers to innovative, better-for-you products, and their customers actively look for brands that support healthier lifestyles. Poppy's bold flavors, eye-catching branding, and a better-for-you ingredients create something shoppers feel good about reaching for. And with 18 flavors and new innovations all the time, there's truly a flavor for everyone. If you'd like to learn more about Poppy or explore our flavors, visit our website or follow us on social media.
Welcome back to the Buyer's Desk. We've come a long way over the past 4 years, and with the arrival of spring, we thought it would be a good idea to look back at the ground we've covered to see what themes are still as relevant as ever today. I'm Sarah Fulton-Kerbling, Retail Marketing Strategist, and we're bringing you an episode from the backstock. Join us as Angela chats with Christine and Richard from Regenified. In a time when higher prices are on everyone's mind, I was struck by the way we often put capital V values at odds with value from a cost perspective. This conversation touches on so many important points, but what stood out for me was how regenerative agriculture is a both and proposition, doing something better for the planet and allowing producers to get better products and increase their profitability. Listen in and see what resonates with you. Here is Prioritizing Animals and the Earth with Regenified.
Hi, it's Angela back on the Buyer's Desk, and I am thrilled today to be joined by two excellent humans from Regenified. First, we have Christine Root. She is the Chief Marketing Officer and the storyteller among us today. I'm also joined by Richard Tufton. He is the VP of Supply Chain in terms of pastured proteins, considering himself a bit of a matchmaker between retailers and farmers. I'm really interested to dive into exactly what you both do, but Christine, if you wouldn't mind kicking us off with just an overview of Regenified, that would be great.
Fantastic. So Regenified is a verification and certification company, and we were founded by farmers, soil scientists, and researchers in the industry who really spent decades understanding what regenerative agriculture meant for the land, how farming impacts ecosystem function, and how we can build healthier, more resilient farmland and a future for our food system.
I love that. How about how long have you guys been operating?
So Regenified was founded in 2022. Some of our founders were Gabe Brown, Alan Williams, Doug Peterson, and they formed a certification company to really protect the integrity and the narrative of regenerative agriculture, so ground truthing what's happening. So they built standards based on all that field-level data that they were capturing and the understanding of the impact that agriculture can have on our land, our landscapes, and also profitability and resilience for our ag systems. But they built that based on helping understand impact. So Regenified is very unique in that we've got the 6-3-4 standards. They're the basis of our certification, and they help us understand and ground truth what's happening at the farm level, both in terms of the practices and then the changes to the outcomes in those ecosystem functions. So it's measured data of across 65 different data points across all the fields on a farm to understand the true impact that a farm is having. And that helps bring transparency to the food system to understand the impact of regenerative agriculture so that when consumers go to shelf, for example, they know that when they pick up a product with that certified Regenified seal, they're supporting transition and change with real measured impact.
A lot to unpack there. We've got like this kind of data-centric grounding. You've got a number of complex standards. You've got a certification that you want consumers to understand at the shelf. Where do you start? Richard, when we were like originally concepting these episodes and really thinking about the animal welfare piece of it, to be honest with you, regenerative agriculture did not occur to me, even though I'm in the industry. And I even had to reach out to Christine and be like, we can talk about animal welfare, right? And now I think about that and I think, oh my gosh, of course, like that's very obvious. Tell me a little bit about your role, what you look for, like kind of an overarching piece about the way that animal welfare and regenerative agriculture play together.
Yeah, well, I think about this often because the Venn diagram between regenerative agriculture and higher animal welfare farms is very connected. And there are so many in that intersection, right? And so you've got farms and farmers who are farming regeneratively, who also, by definition, are farming with higher animal welfare because they're humans who deeply care about the food that they're growing and they take care of their animals the way that they would take care of their own children, for sure, because I've met hundreds of them through the years. I've been in this meat world for about 25 years now. And so at the other end of the space, you've got the consumer who wants to buy better food for themselves and for their families. And most consumers by now have a basic understanding about animal welfare and what that stands for and how important it is to them as a consumer when they're choosing which product to buy. And what's really magical about this relationship is that those exact same farms which are producing higher animal welfare, beef, pork, lamb, chicken, are also in many cases farms who are farming regeneratively. And so it's our job as Regenified to try to make that connection as tight as possible, as close as possible, so that the consumer can really make some informed choices at shelf when they're deciding, you know, which pack of meat to pick up, because the choice is huge. I mean, I come from the UK, which is a tiny country, and the range between the best and the worst in food terms is actually quite small. And I moved, I'll always remember when I first moved to the States, it was about 10 years ago, and my wife was pregnant with our first child, and I had to go and get the bare essentials from my local, it was a Walmart, because that was all we had where we were living when we first got here. And I had to pick up a loaf of bread, a pint of milk, and, you know, something for dinner. And in the UK, I was used to buying milk, full fat, semi-skimmed or skimmed, like three options. And suddenly I'm faced with this aisle, which was like 100 foot long and about 10 feet high with multiple choices. And the same exists for any food type here in the States, meat especially. There's so much choice and the gap between the best and the worst is huge. And at Regenified, it's our job to try to help provide a better understanding, a source of truth, so that consumers can really understand, as I was in that situation, I want to give my wife some nutrient-dense food to feed the growing baby inside of her. Like, how do I do that? It's really difficult. And I'm somebody who does care about climate change, and I do want to see younger people coming back into agriculture. And animal welfare is really important to me. So how do I choose the product in the store that supports that? And that's really what Regenified is all about. And the fact that we have so much overlap with animal welfare is critical to that.
I want to kind of back us up to a little bit about the formation of regenerative agriculture as a principle, because I think that speaks to kind of that cues up what you were just saying, Richard. Regenerative agriculture at its heart is about farming in harmony with nature. And the development of regenerative agriculture was to step back and look at nature's principles and nature's systems. And a big element of that stepping back and reflecting and looking at how nature does things was looking back at how bison roamed the countryside historically, the natural behaviors and patterns of animals when they were living in the wild and had free roam and free control of their own lives. and how they behaved and how that impacted the ecosystems. And that was actually a major unlock in regenerative agriculture, is understanding the benefit of livestock and ecosystems and allowing them to exhibit those natural behaviors that they exhibited when the bison were roaming the countryside, for example, roaming in tight clumps, moving freely through, eating the forage that was available in biodiverse landscapes and living their best lives. But what they left in their wake through their own animal livelihoods was more nutrient-rich soil, was building resilience within those ecosystems. And that regenerative agriculture, exhibiting that or bringing that back into agricultural systems, is really looking to mimic animals' natural instincts and allowing them to do what they do, which is to eat, to forage, to be in community, to roam, and setting that up within an agricultural ecosystem that allows a farm to manage that process. And so when inherently we start getting into, right, we're looking at how animals behave in the wild and living their own instincts. And that's the foundation of animal integration and animal welfare standards within Regenified's ecosystem.
Going to say, just to add to that, I think the fact that animal welfare has become more and more front and center in consumers' minds in the last, 20 years, say, has been because it is kind of the antithesis to factory farming and people's perceptions that factory farming is actually, can be in some situations, cruel. And so you kind of picture yourself on a regenerative farm raising cattle and you're out and I'm in a pasture where the grass comes up to my knees. And once you've turned off any engines of any trucks that have got you into the middle of that pasture, what do you hear? You're hearing a cacophony of birds singing and there are bugs everywhere and there are spider's webs and it's just beautiful. Not just the welfare of the animals being raised by the farmer, but all of the whole wildlife system that you're supporting. And then cut to a feedlot, which is a very common way, maybe 95% of cattle here in the States go through a feedlot. And picture the scene there. You've got a lot that's maybe a mile by a mile, and it's just black cattle as far as you can see in this gigantic, kind of like a car parking lot, really. And they're stood on dirt. And if you turn the engine off, you just hear silence pretty much, which doesn't mean those animals are unhappy, but it's a very different environment. And both situations, which is interesting, hit the kind of basic principles of animal welfare, you know, that they've got freedom from disease, they're not thirsty, they're not hungry. To some degree, they can express natural behavior. So in terms of how the world sets animal welfare principles, both adhere to them, but you can kind of just see it by how what it smells like, what it looks like, the sounds that you observe when you're in that space. There's so much of a positive relationship between regenerative agriculture and animal welfare.
Yeah, I definitely remember when it sunk in. I met a pasture chicken farmer a couple of years ago, just working in grocery. And he spoke about himself, like, I raise like four or five different types of pasture. Yes, the chickens are on and we, you know, he did this very cool crop rotation thing, but he really identified strongly as a farmer of various varieties of clover and grass. And I just like, even just I thought one of those like kind of base, like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense to me that you are actively growing crops and raising animals. And it almost feels to me too, like when we think about regenerative agriculture, we think immediately of farm and we think of, we want the soil to have all of these, this nutrient density that we, you know, used to have a lot easier 100 years ago, and then add the complexity on top of it of then raising an animal. It seems to me that like you really are looking at a group of people. I love how you say that they treat their animals like they would their children, but you are talking about a human who is really not only fighting the good fight, but really adding some complexity to the food system that we've lost a little bit with that family farm. Any chance either of you, like you don't have to give me a name, et cetera, but like want to tell me a story about someone in that realm?
Well, I mean, you know, the whole story of Gabe Brown, I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with this or not. There's an excellent book that I recommend everybody read, which is called Dirt to Soil, which Gabe wrote. And it tells the story of a farmer going from a conventional farm to now a regenerative farm, and some of the differences that he's observed in that time. I flicked through it last night as a kind of refresher before I came on to chat with you today. And there was, or maybe it was on the podcast or something, but he said that Brown's Ranch, which is the name of his farm, now has 105 different nesting bird species active on it right now. And he said that would, you'd have been lucky to get three back when I started this journey. And I mean, just that one little factoid is kind of interesting. The other thing which I think you might enjoy from an animal welfare point of view is that I went to visit his ranch, in fact, with Christine about 6 months ago, and we drove past this pasture which had grass. I'm 6'5", I'm quite tall, and the grass was up to my waist easily. And Gabe says, "Oh, look, and here's my flock of sheep in this field." And I was like, where are we looking for the sheep? I'm so confused. And of course, a sheep is like, I don't know, 3 foot high or something. And there they were in the middle of this insane pasture with 20 different species of grass that was so high. The sheep were in there just having the time of their lives, having this diet of all these different species of grass. Because P.S., animals thrive on having lots of variety in their diet, and it's very rare if you go to any farm across the world to have multiple species of grass in the field, because most cattle farmers, they'll have one or two different species of grass, and that's what they'll focus on, and they'll use fertilizer and man-made inputs to make that one or two species grow. But most ruminants really thrive on, I mean, there are studies out there where they want between 50 and 80 different types of grasses and bushes and trees and all sorts to give them that kind of diversity in which they thrive as animals. And the food that they produce, the meat from their muscles, is much more nutrient dense if they go into a system like that. But actually seeing that on Gabe's place was definitely a moment for me. But Christine, do you have examples?
I mean, it's trying to boil it down to figure out one story or one experience. I think this is just thinking of Burroughs Family Farms in California. They've got an orchard. They've got an almond orchard and a walnut orchard, and they're raising, they're raising these almonds and these walnuts, but they also are building this beautiful habitat with all of this biodiversity, bringing in all of this wildlife. And instead of using management practices like a mower or a tiller, they have sheep. So they're integrating sheep into the landscape. So those sheep are actually the ones who do the job of mowing, bringing down the grasses, this, very biodiverse, rich set of grasses, mowing it down, leaving behind fertilization that helps facilitate and build the ecosystem health for those almond trees, for example. And that's, I think, when we kind of look through examples from the farms and Regenified's network, you just see this symbiotic relationship of how animals and land and crop are all growing in this biodiverse stacked enterprise where each adds another layer of value to the other. And I love your example, Angela, of the farmer who, our farmers truly feel like their goal is to build diverse, rich ecosystems, to build up biodiversity and to leverage the benefit of that for animals, for crop production, for human consumption. All of these things are, starting with ecosystem function and building a healthier ecosystem enables all of the rest of that.
Well, and I've always been interested too. I just remember, early Organic Valley training about their conversion rate of farmers from conventional to organic. And how even if it wasn't something they felt passionately about, they were saving money, their operations were a little more streamlined. So there is a piece of like, oh, you said sheep. And I was like, oh, amazing. Now you're not, buying fuel to run a mower. This is like one less thing on your checklist. And I always love your heart could be in this amazing place, or you could just really want to do the right thing in terms of operations. And we would both of those mindsets would get to a place where we're increasing biodiversity, the quality of the meat is better. I mean, there are all of these interesting data points. Do you have farmers and ranchers that come to you and say, I'm not where you are yet, but I want to get there?
So, Angela, I want to really highlight what you just said is an incredibly important part of regenerative agriculture. There is an element of regenerative agriculture that is doing the right thing, but if it weren't profitable and business-centered, it could not scale. Regenerative agriculture resets the economic value proposition at the farm level, builds resilience and profitability for a farmer, and that is critical because you can do both. In fact, it's critical that you do both because farms are not in a position where they can afford to invest in making the world a better place for everybody else. They're barely surviving in a conventional system right now. So farmers can move into a regenerative system purely because it increases profitability and helps build resilience at the farm level. And the byproduct would be that they're doing something better for the planet and getting better products for us. But I really think that's an important thing for people to understand is that regenerative agriculture is a both and. It's not an either or proposition. And that is really, really critical. And so your question just after that was,
do you have farmers and ranchers that come to you that say, I'm not here, but I want to get there?
Yeah, absolutely. Regenified has a 5-tier structure. So we have 5 tiers within our certification, and the tiers represent the amount of land management practices that farms have in place. So we require all 6 soil health principles in place, but then we're also measuring ecosystem changes. So if they're having a positive measured impact on their ecosystem, those management practices plus the outcomes they're able to achieve is what ranks them in the different tiers. And so a farm may be cover cropping and they may have stopped tilling 5 years ago, but they could come in at tier 1. Maybe their cover crops they're doing 30-day cover crops, which isn't enough time for those roots to go deep into the ground to get the nutrient cycling and benefit, you know, of a cover crop, the full benefit of it. And so it's about kind of looking at both of those, but we often have farms who are saying, look, we can see that there's a pathway forward, that regenerative agriculture can build resilience for our farm. We can see that it can help us achieve our goals better. Let's figure out where we're at right now. And so farms come to us, you know, saying we want to get a baseline, a benchmark of understanding where we're at, because the agronomic data that comes out of the verification process itself, all of the field data we're capturing, helps a farm make decisions at the farm level on how they can change their management practices to get better outcomes. And then we require within those 5 tiers, Regenify requires continuous improvement. So if you came in and you got verified at tier 2, you've got regenerative land management practices and you're having a measured ecosystem outcome across 20 to 40% of your land. But you can't just stay there. You need to use the agronomic data you're getting out of your field verification to make management improvements and start increasing that so that you're having measured outcomes across a broader spectrum of your land as you go all the way up 40 to 60, 60 to 80, and then 80 to 100%. And you have to make those, you have 3 years to progress in that journey.
And think about the signals that we've been giving as buyers to farmers for the last, you know, 80 years. We've been telling farmers, we want you to produce as much food as possible for the lowest price possible. That's what we want from you. And farmers answered that call and they've used glyphosate and all these weird and wonderful chemicals to achieve that goal. And now suddenly we're saying to them, actually, animal welfare is really important to us. So maybe keep slightly fewer chickens in your chicken house, or maybe let those chickens roam outside. Those are things that we're now telling farmers that is interesting to us as buyers, consumers of that meat. And I also think of, Alan Williams says a lot the phrase, farmers can only manage what they know. And one of the big benefits of this whole regenerative system is that we're giving them information that they didn't have before. And so they're starting to understand how much water they can infiltrate in their fields using regenerative principles. And as a result, when their farm is experiencing drought or flooding, their farm is in a much better position than their neighbor's farm. And there are countless examples of, you know, in the movie Common Ground, you know, there's a lot of footage of Gabe standing next to his neighbor's farm, and you can really see the difference. And it makes you think about, you know, it is a fact that extreme weather events happen wherever you are in the world, and it is making your farm more resilient to those extreme weather events. You know, when Gabe took on his farm, he could infiltrate about half an inch of water per hour. And now that's up to 32 inches of water per hour. Now he's in Bismarck, North Dakota, where the annual rainfall is something like, I don't know, 15 inches or 18 inches, or whatever it is. So he could infiltrate way more water than he actually even gets in a year. But if every farm in the world was able to do that, it would be amazing, because suddenly farms could actually make it through droughts, and flooding events would be way less common, because every drop of rain that falls, at least on farmers' soil, is absorbed in the soil and it's held there. And so you kind of think about all of these other positive effects that affect the whole community.
I think it's interesting you brought up Common Ground, because Common Ground was definitely the movie where I realized what a massive undertaking re-education of current farmers would take. And I feel like it's a really, I just love the way you guys are talking about incremental change to get up to a place and then focus on continual improvement. Because I could see this be very overwhelming to someone, despite really having, like, you know, their heart or their business acumen in the right place. This is a broad question, but when you talk to farmers and ranchers, do you feel like the data is more compelling, or do you feel like the outcomes are more compelling? Or if you had to tell me what you think sort of sells your proposition the most, like, could you quantify that for me?
That's really interesting. I mean, I think the outcomes, at the end of the day, achieving the outcomes is the game changer. It's using the data to make decisions that results in better outcomes. I mean, I'm thinking of a farmer in our network right now who, you know, was doing all of the things. They were implementing the land management practices, but they didn't quite understand how it was impacting the ecosystems. Once they got that data, they were able to shift some management practices, and they were able to reduce their farm management costs by 30% in 1 year. 30% less money spent to achieve the outcome, to produce the crop that you need to produce, is money in the bank. Like, that's changed, that tips the scale in profitability for a farm in a dramatic way. And so it really is, you know, at the end of the day, farms are businesses and they have to stay in business. They have to be able to operate, and using data that helps them achieve better profitability, better resilience, as Richard was mentioning, with, you know, with severe weather conditions, being able to manage those much better. But then also knowing that is a continuous positive impact for their farm over time, that they're going to continue to reap the benefit of that. The more health they build in their soil, the more resilience they build into their ecosystem, the work they're doing right now, 5 years from now, is going to be even more valuable. It is really the outcomes that they achieve that becomes really valuable. It's just data to empower the outcomes.
Yeah, and then you think back to why do farmers farm the way they do? It's based on the market. One of the big factors is the market for the products downstream of the farm. So retailers deciding what products to put on shelf and consumers deciding which products to take off that shelf and put in their basket. So you think about all of the different stakeholders in that supply chain that we need to appeal to make this thing work. And data is going to be very important to the downstream success of this movement. And so think about the consumer deciding what pack to put in their trolley, and you think about the nutrient density piece, like condensing this very complex story into something simple. Like, if you pick up this pack of meat, it's going to have 2.7 times more whatever vitamins, minerals, nutrients to nourish your body. Okay, so that's that bit checked. So they're happy, they're going to put that in their basket. But what's going to make a retailer put it on the shelf in the first place to give that consumer a chance to put it in their basket? Data. They're under pressure to answer questions. Is my business sustainable? well, what does that word mean? I'm not sure, but regenerative agriculture is one of the big answers to that question because we have the data to prove it. So that when a corporate entity, a retailer, is writing their annual ESG report, which they have to do to make sure that they're doing the best they can and talking about the truth of their business and the impact that their business has on the planet, we have data to massively help them with that. Okay, well, that's interesting. So now they've got a reason to stock these products on their shelves. And then you come back to the farmer and obviously everything Christine has referred to. But I'll also share with you, I recently went on a road trip. I live in Austin, Texas, and I went out to the East Coast and I went through many farms, which I visited with in Alabama and Mississippi. And I got to speaking to the farmers and asking them about their journeys into the regenerative world. And that there are a lot of pressures that exist outside of profitability and data. And you think of, like, why are you farming this way? Oh, because my dad farmed this way and my grandfather farmed this way. So you're under a lot of family pressure to not make changes. And then the other thing, which I hadn't really thought about, was you're in the middle of nowhere, Alabama. Where do they see their community? They see the whole community once a week on a Sunday in church, and they're all sitting in the same congregation. And suddenly the guy who's the fertilizer salesman is in the same congregation as the farm. And he comes up to him afterwards and he's like, what the hell, man? Like, you're no longer buying my fertilizer. This is my livelihood, my business. And one of the farmers that I spoke to told me this story. And he was like, he said it was really difficult because I'm under a lot of social pressure to not do this. I'm made to feel like an outlier in my community because suddenly I'm now not supporting, you know, Frank's fertilizer business up the road. And that's really difficult. So we've got to show them all of these reasons to do it, to help them really feel part of a community and a growing movement and not an outlier. And that's really important to the success of this whole movement.
I want to just kind of tie back what you were just saying, Richard, to something that we said earlier. Farms were asked to create cheap food. And they lived up to that. None of us knew the unintended consequences that would come when we focus on cheap food in our food system, but we're living the effects of that. And right now we're in a position where we're realizing this is impacting our ability to grow food. We're losing arable land. We're losing farmers, and kids don't want to go back to the farm because it's not a profitable business. We've got a human health crisis because we have lost the nutrients in our food system. There's all of these compounding effects that were started by this one decision, but it's actually going to take all of us to change this. Farms can't change this alone. It is not about asking farmers to right the wrongs. It's about all of us supporting a different initiative and a different foundation, a different way of thinking about our agricultural systems and the role that we have to play in supporting it. Right? So brands, what is your role in changing the food system? If you have these values around creating a better food system, what does it look like to source from farms that can have that positive impact? Retailers, if you're a values-based retailer, what is your role in creating transition and supporting change so that we have a future agriculture and we have a food system that exists in 50 years? Consumers, what is your role if you care about these values? What does that look like? Right. So we all have a role to play in supporting. And I think that's the exciting thing. When you watch, Angela, as you mentioned, Common Ground, you realize that this touches all of us in different ways, but we all have a role to play and we can be a supporter and a champion for impact.
So much to unpack there, you guys. There are so many interesting insights there. I do think that when I think about it from the retail perspective, which is primarily our audience for this podcast, and you think about the way that we talk about the word value as being a little bit more than cost. And yes, to your point, this, like, we do need consumers to be paying higher price points so that the whole food supply chain can all thrive appropriately. And it's like so many decisions, it's so many different pieces of this. I find that to be super compelling. But also, Richard, what you said about having a larger community, but also the kind of like the peer pressure to stay the same is fascinating because change is hard, even if you had a whole group of people that wanted to change. But to be the only person in your community that's trying to do a thing, I find that to be A, incredibly inspirational on the part of the farmer that is trying so hard, but also B, like wouldn't like, you know, just layers upon layers of complexity and challenge here that I just so appreciate the work that you guys do. Sincerely, it's very complicated, complex, and needed. And it's not easy to be out there all the time fighting the good fight and helping people with a whole myriad of issues. I could keep talking and ask you a million additional questions, but I will wrap this up by just asking you both, when you were asked to come on the Buyer's Desk today to talk about animal welfare as it relates to Regenified, is there anything we did not talk about that you would like to make sure that we include here at the end?
Yeah, well, I think a really important thing to think about is the health of the animals. And I'll give you two examples of where regenerative raised animals are more healthy than non-regeneratively raised animals and why that's interesting. One is with worms. Let's talk about worms. Cattle, and I'm not talking about the good worms in the soil. I'm talking about the worms that cattle get dewormer for every year. In a conventional system, dewormer is really expensive and you have to give it to cattle because they get it quite often. And when a beef animal has worms, I hope no one's eating their food whilst they're listening to this. They basically end up having chronic like diarrhea, basically. And it's really a horrible thing for an animal to have to go through. Anyway, it's quite expensive to treat them every year. Regenerative farmers don't even have to give the cattle dewormer. Why? Because the way that you graze regeneratively, that you're only grazing kind of the top 20-30% of the grass plant, if you can visualize that, and all of the bacteria that give the animals these problems live in the base of the grass plant. So by not overgrazing grass, you're also creating an animal that's more healthy because they're not eating parts that really in the wild they wouldn't be eating because you're keeping them in a paddock too long. So it's really helpful for that. The other thing is avian bird flu. So I don't know if you've noticed, and I'm sure your consumers have and your listeners, that egg prices are crazy high. And that's predominantly, there are many factors, but one of the main ones is avian bird flu. And this is a disease that chickens get and is very easily transferred. When you look at the regenerative community, the outbreaks of avian bird flu are minimal, if at all, because the birds are much more healthy. And even though they're exposed to the same amount of bird flu as the rest of the birds in the world, they don't pick it up because they have a more healthy immune system because their diet is more diverse and they're just healthier animals. So I think that's just a really interesting little factoid just to highlight that, yeah, we're working on human health with this food, but also we're working on animal welfare and animal welfare health, because we're giving them a diverse diet and a better life, and it makes them stronger, fitter, healthier animals, which has got to be a good thing for everybody.
Which is what builds that resilience for those livestock ranchers, right? Having healthier animals who are able to adapt and cope to these kind of stressors ensures that they're likely to be more resilient to, you know, major influencers like bird flu.
Yeah. And I just think it's critical for this movement and for the industry that companies like Regenified are hand in hand with animal welfare verifier companies too, because we need to make this pathway as easy as possible, both for a consumer wanting to buy products like this, but also farmers wanting to raise animals and crops like this, because the point is that we're doing exactly the same thing, but we're just focused on slightly different things. We're focused on soil and they're focused on animal welfare, but we're basically talking to the exact same farmers. And we're also talking to demand of brands and retailers for the same product. So there's so much overlap in what we're both doing. And so we have to do this together.
I think what's really interesting is that as I talk to brands, brands feel that their customer is the retailer, because that's the person who decides what goes on shelf and what consumers get to purchase. And so the role that retailers play in our food system is way more powerful than I think a lot of retailers realize, right? You actually get to help expose consumers to new thoughts, new ideas, bring products to market that can swing and move the market in ways that I don't know if everyone really appreciates.
Right. I mean, I will say, you know, this is an infra podcast. We are the Independent Natural Food Retailers Association. And so many of our members' origin stories are they got sick, their spouse got sick, their kid got sick. They realized the importance of diet. When they realized the importance of diet, they felt a calling to open a store in their community where people could get food that actually nourishes them. I think on a lot of levels, and our membership is like, I totally agree with you that our membership is an anomaly on that level. But we really do work with a lot of humans that just want to feed the community good food. We know we're never going to be the lowest price in town. We totally know that we need to have people in the aisles explaining why this is $39.99 and that one is $11.99. But yeah, I mean, on some levels, it is very aspirational. I never thought about it, actually, in terms of I've been in retail my entire career, too many decades to joke about at the moment. But I never thought about the brand really thinking about the retailer. But it's true. It's a saturated marketplace. It is. We are asking consumers to make a whole, just the number of decisions you make in a grocery store is insane. It's like, I totally understand why people don't like grocery shopping on that level. But yeah, thinking about the relationship between the brand and the retailer, what a retailer values would absolutely reflect back on a brand, right? That's what startup brands want. Like, tell me what the consumer wants. Like, fascinating way to think about that. Yeah.
And also think about the consumer, like why does the consumer choose to shop at a certain shop? Because you trust that they've put products on that shelf that are safe for you to eat and for your family to eat. And that's not always true. Like when you actually dig into it and do the research, there's such, like I started this podcast with the story of going to a gigantic Walmart for the first time. When you start to dig into some of the ingredients of milk, you're like, wow, why is that even a thing in milk? That, like, I just want milk from a cow that is just milk with no other additives in it, things like that. But you trust that the retailer has made a good decision and done all the work for you because you've got 2 seconds to make that decision and you've got 2 screaming kids in your shopping cart. Like, you haven't got time to do that research in that moment. And so I think your listeners have got a critical role to play in this path in doing the hard work and, you know, earning the trust of the shopper who's chosen to shop at their store. And, you know, brands can only work so hard in their messaging. And it does get confusing really quickly, like the difference between free range and pasture raised and, you know, all of these terms that is confusing. But the hope is, oh, well, there's a buyer somewhere who's decided to put this on shelf, who is an expert, who has done hours of research. And so that's why it's really important that we're, you know, everyone feels like we're in this together. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. We can all curate more. We can all like stand for something. It's not easy, but to your point about incremental change, I'd love to feel like that is at least where some double digit percentage of the food system is going. And organizations like yours give me a lot of hope. And so I just want to say thank you. Christine, I bet you could wrap us up by letting us know where people can go to find more information about Regenified.
Absolutely. You can find information. We have social channels on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. We also have a website at www.regenified.com. We share information and resources there. And one piece that may be really valuable to the infra community is the consumer insights research we did this summer, which you'll find on our resources page. But we dug in and talked to 850 consumers to understand what are consumers looking for? How much do they understand regenerative agriculture? And those are the kinds of things that we're creating because we want to help people be informed about what's happening in the marketplace. We want to share knowledge and help accelerate wherever we can be an amplifier and supporter in this community.
Thank you both so much for your time today. I really hope this is just the beginning of a conversation and that we have a way to pick this up because this is definitely not an issue that is going away. For all of you out there listening, thanks so much again for joining the Buyer's Desk today. See you next time.
As we wrap up this episode of The Buyer's Desk, we'd like to extend our heartfelt thanks to the incredible infra staff contributors, dedicated independent retailers, and visionary natural food brands and business partners that made this episode possible.
Stay tuned for more inspiring insights and stories in the world of natural food retail. Until next time, thank you for your support. Angela Bozo, co-host and administrator.
Kim Rout, executive producer and segment contributor.
Jim Olson, Spin's segment manager.
Austin Hinkle, audio engineer.
Sarah Super, wellness strategist.
Madeline Ware, marketing writer, editor, and digital manager.
Haley Craig, audio engineer and segment contributor.
Raina Kittredge, segment contributor.
Bella Sislo, outreach manager and segment contributor.